Greetings, peace and blessings to everyone. It's an honor today to present to you a very special guest tonight. For our Black History Month presentation, we have Lisa McNair here. She's a sister of one of the little girls who was killed in the 16th Street bombing in Birmingham, Alabama, in 1963. And Ms. McNair is a relative of Dr. Maddox, our principal at one of our high schools here, Compton Early College. And she spoke recently at our Black History ceremony. It was a great presentation. She shared some highlights of her story, as well as spoke of a textbook that she has, a book that she wrote regarding her sister. I think it was Letters to Denise. Really, really great book. I haven't had a chance to read it, but I'm looking forward to reading it. And it's available now for you to pick up on Amazon. And other Barnes & Noble, I think some other places as well. So I thought this would be a great platform just to share some of the information. There's a lot of information about some of the things that went on she had shared, as well as another girl who actually was injured in the bombing that no one really knows about, no one really talks about. And also family members who actually got into political office in during that time to help. Fight for justice and bring those people who actually did the bombing to justice. So it was a really good story. I thought this would be a good opportunity for her to share. So thank you. You have the floor, Ms. McNair.
Okay. Hello, everyone. And thank you all for having me today. I really appreciate it. As Mr. Hood was saying, my name is Lisa McNair, and I am the younger sister of Denise McNair, one of the four girls killed in the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in 1963, September of 1963. I did not know my sister. She was 11 at the time of her murder, and she was the only child of my parents, Maxine and Chris McNair. My parents had tried to have other children many, many times since she was born, but my mother could never carry the baby to term. So you can imagine how horrible it was to lose a child in that way, but then also not be able to have any more children. But God is good and he is faithful. And almost a year from the day she was born, I was born. She was killed on September 15th, 1963. And my birthday is September 19th, 1964. And then my mom and dad kept trying even more miscarriages and a stillbirth. And then four years later, at 40, my mother gave birth to my younger sister, Kim, and she is a professional chef here in the Birmingham area. I am a public speaker, and I travel the country speaking about bombing and reconciliation, how we can come together and know that we are more alike than we are different. So that's what I've been doing. And then last year I published a book, Dear Denise, Letters to the Sister I Never Knew. And that's a picture of her, my dad's favorite picture of her, actually, holding her Chatty Cathy doll. What's I think it's significant is she's holding this white doll that she just loves, but she didn't have a black doll because they didn't make any black dolls back then for little girls to have. And so I always wanted to write this book and share my story as being part of that first generation of African Americans who were allowed to move freely throughout the country after segregation was abolished. And so I tell very honestly my story of going to predominantly white private schools that our parents put us in and what that really was like for me, the ups and the downs of that. So that's part of what I share in my book. Plus also I share the tragedy that happened to my parents, Maxine and Chris McNair, and what it was really like for them to have lost their daughter in such a terrible, terrible, tragic way. As Mr. Hood was saying, the girls were there were four five girls in the bathroom that day, and the fifth girl was Sarah Collins Rudolph, and she was Addie Mae Collins. Addie Mae Collins was one of the girls who was killed. That was her sister, and she was just far enough in the bathroom that she was not killed, but she lost her right eye and suffered a lot of shrapnel damage during that time of the bombing. My dad, after the bombing, went on the radio and he talked to people, and he said that he wanted us to show the better parts of ourselves and not to go out and riot, but to show the better part of ourselves. And people have often credited him with Birmingham not being blown up with violence and riots because of what he said at that time. In 1973, he wanted to honor Denise's memory by being elected to the state legislature. So he ran in the district where we live, which I didn't put together till recently, that that district at that time was not predominantly Black. And he won. And he was the first African American elected to the state legislature from Jefferson County. And he served many, many terms. And then he left to run his own photography business, and which he really wasn't that good. He was an excellent photographer, but he was a terrible businessman. So my mom was like, "You need to get a job and like make some money." And so he wanted to do also wanted to be a county commissioner. There had never been a Black county commissioner, so he ran for county commissioner and was elected to that position and served several terms during that job. So let's see. I want you to come in and ask some questions, but I want to say some other things just to fill in the gaps and keep people up to date. The first person convicted of Denise's bombing was Denise's murder was not brought to justice until 1977, 14 years after the bombing took place. And his name was Dynamite Bob Chambliss. And he was convicted of murdering Denise and served a life sentence in prison. And just a side note, I didn't say this in the presentation the other day. He actually wrote us a letter afterwards talking about what a good person he was and how if we could help him get out of jail, because he didn't really do it. Anyway, so my daddy quickly just tossed that letter aside, like, seriously. Let's see. The last two people who committed the murders were not brought to justice until 2001 and 2002. There were more people, but they died between 1963 and 2001 and 2002. And these are the last two guys that were left. And they both were given life sentences for killing the four girls, and they served until they died. So the girls also were able to get the Congressional Gold Medal, which is the highest honor that a citizen can be given in Congress. And they were given that in 2013 at the 15th anniversary of the bombing. And after the bill was passed in both houses of Congress, we got to meet President Obama and see him sign the bill, me and my mom in the Oval Office. So, justice was delayed, but it was not denied. And my parents moved on to have two more children and have a wonderful life, but they never stopped grieving or missing Denise.
All right, that's an excellent presentation. Mashinda, you're from Louisiana, and you've seen a lot of the issues, and I'm pretty sure you know about the 13th, I mean the 16th Street Baptist bombing and some of the perspectives of that. You want to say anything or ask any questions, Brother Mashinda?
Yeah, I'm here. No, I'm just listening. I just want to welcome the guests. Thank you for sharing, the tribute, to your sister's beautiful, and your research. I'm sure it's therapeutic for you at the same time, you know. So I just appreciate you sharing that information. I'm interested in purchasing the book.
Thank you. Brother Hood, did you have any questions? You're on mute.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I had a question. Ms. McNair, when your father entered in politics, how did he navigate that? Like, was there another congressman, or how did he decide that he wanted to go for that particular office at the local level? Like, what made him, did he have a mentor? What was that like? Because you said it was predominantly white. Like, how did he actually get the wherewithal to run?
I guess he just wanted to run for that position. I don't think I've ever talked with him about why he did it. I know he wanted to honor her by being a public servant. So that's why he got involved. And the area we lived in was not predominantly black at that time, but Daddy was the type of man who was just really good with all kinds of people. He knew how to shake your hand and have a conversation with you. And, you know, it didn't matter whether you were white or black, he could reach you on a level of a human being to human being. So he was just real good at that. And good with that, with all people. That's just who he was. And he was an excellent state legislator and kind of commissioner. I never forget, he always we never changed our phone number. In fact, still got the same phone number here at the house. And people would call all times of days and night needing something. And we were like, Dad, can we get a new phone number, you know, or can we be unlisted? And he was like, nope, but I got to be available for the people to reach me. So we're going to keep this number. And we always did. And I just thought that was cool about him. I mean, people would be stuck on the side of the road. He would go help them put a towel in their car, push their car off the road, and he was just that kind of a guy. And what he had done before that, at the time of Denise's death, he was a teacher at Parker High School, which was the first black high school here. But before that, he was the milkman. So he got, everybody fell in love with Chris McNair being the milkman. When he died a couple of years ago, people was like, oh, I miss your daddy so much. He was my milkman. Most people in Birmingham knew him as the milkman. And, you know, he just loved people. And that's how he was able to communicate with them.
Okay, that's great. So it makes sense now. So if he's a milkman, he had already kind of had a presence in the community. And everybody knew him. So when he ran, he didn't have to do a whole bunch of marketing. His name was already there. So that makes sense.
But back then, you know, he did the grassroots thing, walking and knocking on doors. I remember every time he went for, you know, for to get reelected, we had to get up early on Saturday morning and just beat the streets, knocking on doors, passing out flyers, talking to people. And he would buy us Burger King. And we'd get a Whopper for helping him. But he even ran for Congress one time. He didn't make it, but he also ran for the U.S. Senate, and he came dangerously close. He was really this close to being our first black U.S. Senator. We haven't had one since he ran, and that was a whole big thing. There were two big political parties here, machines that were run by two black people, and so basically they controlled the black vote because they would make the ballots and that kind of thing. It was a real good thing because it helped the black people stay engaged and know what was going on. But, you know, money gets in the way and people get crazy. So these two guys didn't know Daddy wanted to run for Senate, and he decided to run for Senate, and they was pissed that he didn't go and consult them like he needed to do that, and he didn't. And so when he ran, he was running against a white guy who's Richard Shelby, who's our senator that just retired. And he was there for, I don't know, 7, 8 terms. I'm not sure. But he ran against Richard Shelby, and this black machine was so powerful that all they had to do, like they do with anybody else that was black on the ticket, was endorse the black person, which was Daddy. But they were so mad because I don't know whether they wanted to be senator or mad because he didn't ask them. They didn't endorse Daddy, but they knew they couldn't come out and just not endorse the only black person running against white person. So they did something called a dual endorsement. Endorsed the white guy and the black guy and Daddy. And so that split the vote, and he didn't win. Because at that point, the white guy was Democrat. They were running the Democratic Party. And the Republicans had not taken a stronghold in Alabama like they have now. And he would have easily been able to beat the Republican opponent. And we would have had a senator back in the 80s who was a black man. But they kept that. They messed that up. And I still salty with both them brothers every time I run into them. I've kind of forgiven them a little bit, but they're still a little pissed about that. And I write about that in my book. And that senator just retired after he was there a term or two, one term, and then he returned to Republican, switched parties. And we've never had a black senator since.
Okay. Interesting. So during that time, what were some of the challenges with some of the other, you know, citizens in the community, you know, joining his ranks and becoming a politician as well? Was it a lot of fear at that time? Was he kind of like a beacon to try to, of hope to try to run and get other people, or was it just he was just going to go for it to honor his daughter's memory? Like, what was that?
Well, I think, you know, he started a lot of other people running. So after he ran, there were a lot more people in, you know, predominantly black districts here in Jefferson County that ran. I mean, some of those jokers are still in my dad died. He's 83 because there's a couple of dudes still in office. That was in office with Daddy, but they might need to move on. But yeah, they it sparked an interest. So there were, you know, a whole black contingent of black people in this county and in other counties that elected black people to the legislature. So we have had a good representation of our people at that time.
What is the demographics in that area as far as black to white ratio, would you say?
In Birmingham, the black people are the majority. At one point, it was like 70 to 30, 70% black, you know, the rest white and other. We may have lost a little bit simply because Birmingham has grown in the last few years. As downtown, like some downtowns, was dead, and then they revamped downtown. You know, when you get a grocery store downtown, then you know that's it. So we have a grocery store downtown. So a lot of the older buildings have been remodeled, and new buildings have been built. And there's a big growth of people who live downtown in Birmingham. But it's Birmingham itself. You know, it's very different because in 79, when we got our first black mayor, you had all that white flight. So white people moved to the suburbs like they did in many cities and left the black people there. And so in Birmingham, we have a black mayor now. He's real cool, real sharp brother. And so it's very, Birmingham is very cool. Birmingham is a very progressive city. Very fair city. It's a cool place to be and a cool place to visit. A great food mecca. Oh my God, so many great places to eat. But it's funny, when those people did the white flight, it's like, you know, Birmingham is this ball, and then around the ball are all these little balls, which are cities, subdivisions that created their own cities that are all predominantly white.
Okay.
And they are part of the people that ran away from Birmingham when Birmingham got their first mayor. So, but what has also happened is some of those areas really are now heavy components of Black people, because as Birmingham started to decline in the 80s and 90s with the school system, some of our people were moved to the suburbs to get better school systems. So it's really a mix around the area. And in the last maybe 10 years or so, that racism thing for those people that flew away from Birmingham has reared its ugly head, because you got Black people and white people living next to each other. And then the school system makes these ridiculous, or the city makes these ridiculous rules about something in school. And then they're like, what? You know, I can't believe right. they would do that. And they get on the news, and you had a little white people who are mad and fighting with the Black people because they live next to this Black woman that they just love. And then you have the mayors and things who are trying to do dirty work. And, you know, but then what they don't understand is that we have bonded, you know, the more we integrate, the less you're going to be able to split us up as a race of people, because it's just not going to happen. You know, they're going to be, we're going to fight it. And there will be some white allies who will fight it. And then they got the Indian people and you got the Hispanic people. And, you know, we're just not going back down that road, and we're going to fight them all the way. So Birmingham is pretty cool, but mostly just right in Birmingham. And then the next big county is Shelby County, and it's butts up against Birmingham. So,
okay. So my next question is, so I know, like, you mentioned a white flight, and I know there's a lot of actions from the state to redistrict and gentrify neighborhoods and try to remap the political landscape. Similar like to Texas, I know that a lot of that happened in Texas. Has that happened in Alabama as well? Is there a chance that it could okay?
Because when the Republicans took over in the country, they took over here. You know, Alabama state legislature had been Democratic heavy for decades. And now it, for the last, I guess, maybe at least two election cycles or more, it's been Republican. And so they've tried to do a bunch of foolishness like that here. And it's been challenging, because if the votes in Birmingham, Jefferson County, Shelby County are going to be fairly progressive, but it's the outlying areas of the whole rest of the state, which tend to be rural, where it's very difficult to get a vote through and to get some good work done through. It's a fight. It's a constant fight. But we as Black people have got to be diligent, and our white counterparts have got to fight in the fight with us. And we can't be asleep. We got to, as that term that, you know, everybody's saying woke, we really got to wake up and stay awake. Earlier this past, in last year, around the summer, they were trying to vote a thing called divisive concepts, which would not let certain things be taught in schools. And I heard it on NPR, the local NPR station, and then I didn't hear about it anymore, and just not enough. And then, like, that should have been a headline story. So it passed this House here in our legislature, but it didn't. Then it went to the Senate. And if it passed the Senate, then it was going to be law. And so I went down to Montgomery. The House would not have an open forum for the citizens to complain about it. Mm-hmm. They just took the vote and blocked that. But the Senate did have an open forum, and I drove down to the open forum to talk about how I thought it was wrong that they were trying to do that. And I was telling them that that means that my story of my sister would not be able to be told. And so nobody knew I was coming. And I took an 11 by 14 picture of Denise down there with me to Montgomery. And when I got up there and I spoke to them, you know, I think I threw them off the game. And and then I talked to them, and a couple of the old white guys, they were like, "Wasn't your dad in the legislature?" I said, "Yeah, I worked with him." And then two or three of them, "I did too." And I did too. And I said, "Yes, and he would not be happy with y'all. What y'all doing right now, because he worked across the aisle, and he would know tell y'all that this was not right, And this was not fair. And what I also wanted to say, if you was down there with Daddy, your behind is too doggone old still be there. But I didn't say that because that wouldn't be polite, courteous. So then the guy who was the Speaker of the Senate, the big man, was a guy named Jabbo Wagner. And I remember him from being in the legislature with Dad. And I think sometime they would catch a ride. We would ride down with Dad. And dude is still in the legislature. Oh, my God. And he's like old. But I saw him in the hallway, and I had been calling him all week, trying to stalk him to get him to not vote for that. And when I told him who I was, he the eyes got full. He said, "I remember Chris. He was a nice man. I miss him." And I was like, "Thank you." And I said, "But he wouldn't be happy with you if you vote for that." I said, "I'm appealing to you, please, not to vote for that." He said, "Okay, I'm gonna see what I can do. I'm gonna see what I can do." And they didn't vote for it. They let the it was the that was the last week of the legislature, and they let it all slide. And so that bill dropped. Now, that's not to say that they're not going to try and create another bill like that. But we've got to be in their face and have these conversations and watch what they're doing, because we sleep on the politicians too much. We elect them, and then we don't go to the legislature. We don't read the paper. We don't see what the votes are. And then they're like, "Well, why they got did that? Well, I didn't know they were doing that." Well, that's because you weren't paying attention. We got to pay attention and stay on our game. It has to be as much a responsibility as getting the oil changed in your car, you know, taking your children to school, or getting up and going to work in the morning, voting every time you need to vote, or, you know, then paying attention to what your politicians do, because they work for us. We don't work for them. They work for us.
I agree. Thank you for that. It's amazing when you think about it, the what really it takes, 12, it's like 12 different local government offices, you know, and then you try to understand, like, this younger generation, how they're going to fill that gap. And it's just like, it's two separate realities that they're living in. So I just appreciate, you know, the insight that you have. What do you think you would say as far as the younger generation who may be interested in getting into politics, what would you recommend they do? Like, what should they go for? You know, judges, commissioner offices. I mean, there's so many different offices. To
all of it. All of it. Yeah. You know, we need to have our face into place with all of it. You know, definitely the judges, and, you know, because they are really handing down stuff that's critical that we... I think most of us don't pay attention to what the judges do at all. We really are kind of, it's kind of off of our radar. But, you know, that's why, you know, Trump was so hard pressed to push those judges and get them appointed. And some of them are appointed in there for life. And they're going to make decisions on stuff that's going to matter to us for way past a 4-year election cycle. And we definitely got to do that. But not just the judges, but every position, your city councilor, your legislature, state legislature, your senator, your everybody, school board, definitely school board, you know. And that is really important for us to reach out and stay on top of what's going on. We just can't be asleep, y'all. We got to pay attention. And it may be a little different from y'all back over there in California, y'all. But I mean, y'all have some challenges too. But it's crazy over here.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah, a lot of challenges are similar though, from what I can see in a lot of different areas. When you really sum it up.
Yep, y'all kind of got an attitude about you that some people here don't have. When you've spent so much time.
Yeah.
In an oppressed environment, I find that people here they just kind of ignore things, or that's sad and depressing and I don't want to think about it, and or nobody's going to listen to me anyway, nothing's going to work if I, you know, and so it's that negative spin we can't, we see with that zone we seem to get into We've got to fight our way back out of it because, yes, well, that's what you say. You speak that into existence, and that's exactly what's happening. Nothing's going to happen for you. And we can't do that.
Brother Hembrick, do you have any comment?
Yeah, appreciating what's been said, Sister McNair. I have a relative. First of all, I want to say I have a relative from that area back in the day. His name was Sidney Hembrick. Is there a town around there called Paris or something like that? Around the Birmingham area?
Kind of doesn't ring a bell. I mean, it may be one of the, you know, little small towns outside of Birmingham.
It was a little small town. Anyway, one of my grandfather's, I don't know who this guy was, but his name was Sidney Hembrick, and he was an educator down there. They named a junior high school after him.
Oh, that's awesome.
Way back in the day. I have a friend that's a museum curator down in Birmingham, but she's at a musical museum. Her name is Leah Tucker McGuire. And I have an aunt, not an aunt, but a cousin in Chicago who's about 90 years old. She's our matriarch historian of our family. And she's been trying to research this school that was named after our relative. Come to find out that the school got burned down.
Oh, no.
Then when they rebuilt it, they named it after a white guy.
Oh, darn.
But the guy's name was Sidney Hembrick. And my aunt, my cousin in Chicago, had some correspondence with the superintendent of Birmingham Schools. And she sent him a letter, and she was inquiring about the school that was named after Sidney Hembrick. And she has not heard back. So anyway, you're down there. Maybe you can look it up and see what you can find out. But anyway, I do appreciate your presentation and what you're bringing, you know, to the forefront. But I just wanted to add that a little bit in there since you're down there. I need to talk to my cousin in Chicago and get the exact name of that city where the school was built. But anyway, I know it's a struggle down there, and you know, all the only thing the white folks want black people to do down there is play football for the University of Alabama.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So anyway, you know, great work. I hope you can get the curriculum situated down there where they can include your book and others with this what do they call it? Critical race theory thing that's going around the nation now, where they don't want to teach any black history because of fear of what the white kids will feel from the guilt that should be upon, you know, them for things they have done. Anyway, appreciate you, and thanks for being on tonight.
Thank you. Thank you.
And Brother Rocky Key.
Yes. Good evening again, Ms. McNair.
Good evening.
I wanted to ask you, now you're, well, you would consider yourself a civil rights person. Would you consider yourself that?
Well, I'm a civil rights family member, and I guess I am an activist in my own way.
Okay, so other than your sister, your father, is there any other personality that inspires you to do the type of work that you're doing?
Oh, wow. Just being a human being, a black person in this country. We've got to fight for our rights to exist, to have a place in this country that we help build. I definitely want to do this work in memory of Denise and the sacrifice that, you know, my family made by losing her, and never want her name to be forgotten, and what happened to her and the other little girls. So I don't know that I necessarily have any one person that I do this for or that looks up to. I do love Bryan Stevenson and his work. He's somebody that I follow, and I really believe in what he's doing, and I appreciate his work. I love John Lewis. He was a friend of our family, and his sacrifice and his work.
Who was that again? Brian who?
Bryan Stevenson.
Stevenson, can you tell us a little bit about him? I'm not familiar with him.
Okay, he's the guy that wrote the book Just Mercy. They made it into a movie, The Lawyer. He also founded the Equal Justice Initiative. And they helped to get people who are on death row or who've been wrongly convicted off convicted. You saw that movie, the black movie about the black man that was in prison. And he'd been in prison for 30 years for somebody killing somebody he didn't do. That Michael B. Jordan guy played him a couple years ago.
I remember that.
Go back and watch that.
Great movie. Yes.
Yeah, that was a great movie. Great movie. I think he was nominated for an Oscar for that. Yeah. So he's done tremendous work, and he also has done the Legacy Museum, where he has made a museum in Montgomery. Based on the slave trade and then lynching. They call it the Lynching Museum. People, and it's just been so powerful that it has turned around the tourism funding in Montgomery. People have been coming from all over the world to see that museum the last 5 or 6 years. So y'all got to come on out there and see it. But yeah, the Legacy Museum and Bryan Stevenson, yeah, Google him, YouTube him. He's got some amazing speeches, and he's doing the work. He really is doing a fabulous job.
Thank you.
If I can interrupt for a quick minute, the name of that town is Parrish, 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 Alabama. Never heard of it.
I've heard of it, but I don't know where it is.
Okay, well, that's where the school was. So anyway, just FYI. All right.
Yeah.
Roger Key, you want to continue?
Oh, that's it. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Appreciate what's been said, if I understand correctly. I just have a few questions for you. And again, we want to thank you for taking time. I know you said you had an hour, so I'll try to get going. First of all, I want to say that, you know, What motivates you to write these letters to Denise and write the book? I mean, why did you decide to write the book? And what year did you publish it?
Well, the book just came out last September, this past September. So it's only been out a few months. University of Alabama Press is the publisher. And I wanted to write it because... that's him. That's Bryan Stevenson. I wanted to write it because I wanted to share my story of being one of the first, that part of that first generation of African Americans who were allowed to move freely through this country. And after segregation was no longer the law of the land. And my experiences were very much unlike many African Americans that I knew. And so I wanted to share that with other people and talk about my struggles and talk about the high points and the good points. But I never really heard anybody share that. And so I wanted to write about that, and even since I was 14. But I didn't put pen to paper until 2006 when I started writing it. And then it took me 11 years to finally get my final version. And after about a year or so, I got stuck. And one of my friends I was talking to her about, you know, what can I do? And she said, well, why don't you make it where you write letters to Denise? Because you would have told her anything about your life. And, that's how I formed the letter. So that really made it much easier to get the word out and to start writing. So I started writing all these letters as if I were telling her what happened in the world and in my life since she was murdered. And I can read you some of the, I have a couple excerpts that I could read if y'all would like me to.
Go ahead.
So Spike Lee's Four Little Girls, have y'all seen that, for the documentaries, Four Little Girls?
I saw it when it first came out, but I can't remember all that detail. But...
Well, if y'all haven't seen it, well, you know, please watch it. It's a excellent documentary that Spike Lee did of the four little girls and their families and what life was really like back then. He was nominated for an Academy Award for it, and it is just very well done. So I write in the book, of course, about our experience meeting Spike, him coming into the house, and my dad was a professional photographer. That was his full-time job. And being that Denise was the first child, there were tons and tons of pictures and artifacts and toys of hers. So when Spike came, he saw all the pictures, and he was looking through pictures, and he was like, "Oh, get all of her things together. I want to see everything that she has because I want to use it for my film." And so he left, and while we was gone, he asked us to find all these things. And so Mom and Daddy and I were the only ones living here in the house at this time, and he wanted us to be looking for them and have them all ready. So this is writing about the time we were looking for those things. Well, by this time, things in our house had been moved around quite a bit during a couple of remodels. There were pictures and things of yours, remember I'm writing this to Denise, in a number of closets all over the house. Mama and I got right on the task we were assigned, pulling pictures and your personal effects. It was a sad time. We have a few moments of laughter as well. Mama had stories about lots of things that we found. It was good to do that with her. I had hoped that Daddy would help and be a part of that process. I looked forward to hearing stories from him, but he would always manage to be too busy to help us. It made me and Mama angry that we were doing all of the work. One day, when we were going through a particular closet, he was home all day, which was rare. We asked him to please help us. He sat down for a little while, then shortly afterwards got up to leave. I asked him how could he leave us with all that we had to do, and he yelled back at me, "I just can't." He had tears in his eyes. Mama touched my shoulder and told me to leave him alone. That was the first time I had seen him cry over you. He had held all that hurt and pain in for so many years and never dealt with it. I felt so bad for him. I later went to his room and gave him a big hug and apologized for fussing at him. It broke my heart to see him like that, but I was glad that he was finally grieving. Once the documentary was completed, there were many premieres all over the country. Kim and I went to two of the premieres, but Mama and Daddy went to all of them and cried at every single one. I guess Daddy was finally free to grieve.
That's beautiful. Thank you. Now, let me just ask you this question. Because, you know, you were 11 years behind her, is that correct?
I was 1 year behind her. She died in 63 and I was born in 64. Okay. Almost a year.
So you went through segregation.
No, segregation was done by the time I came.
Segregate with Bull Connor and Judge and
Yeah, George. But I was born in 64, so I'm a baby. So I don't have any frame of reference.
But segregation was still there while you were a baby.
Yeah. But by the time I got ready to go to school or do anything, you know, all that stuff was, they weren't doing that anymore.
Yeah, but that was a result of struggle because the 16th Street Baptist Church was the biggest church in Alabama mm-hmm. at that time, and it was the center of the civil rights movement, if I'm not of they had meetings down there a lot.
Yeah, for Birmingham. Mm-hmm.
And now, there was a fifth girl, Rudolph. Did you ever talk to her?
Yeah, I talked to her yesterday.
How's she doing? Because she said she went through drugs, she went through alcohol, and then she went through Jesus.
Yep. She's been through it. But she's doing great.
Yeah.
Now, she has her own book. She has her own book called The Fifth Little Girl. Mm-hmm. And she travels the country speaking to people, speaking to groups. And she's had to go to Atlanta. I think she's in Atlanta today. So she and her husband.
Okay, then give her warm greetings from us. And then second, I thought it was other people hurt too.
There were a number of other people hurt, but there were only the five girls in that bathroom, in the ladies' lounge. Other people were in other parts of the church.
Yeah, they said it was about 22 people or 14 to 22.
Mm-hmm.
Second, when you look at the fact that there was some resistance, I mean, even before that's one reason they bombed the church, because it was an activist church and things of this nature. You had C.V. Villian, you had people trying to integrate the University of Alabama at that time, and you had resistance at that time, and then you say your father was elected to a position, but Bull Connor and C.V. Williams, I don't know if you remember him, C.V. Williams, the minister.
C.T. Vivian?
C.T. Vivian.
Okay.
Because Bull Connor hit him, and he told him, what kind of people are you in the eyes of the pride? My point is that Alabama, there was some resistance. It wasn't like everybody was going along with what was going on. There was effort from various organizations, because I know there was a lot of people that would not stand up, but there were a lot of people, some people that did stand up and fought and demonstrated. Now, when you look at the the role of George Wallace, I mean, he was governor for a good while, if I'm not mistaken. So did you get a chance to experience his segregation for now and forever mentality down there?
Well, no, by the time I came along, he had supposedly had a change of heart, and it changed the way he felt and believed about
after that. After he got hit and shot or something.
Yeah.
After he was hit and shot, because I think somebody forgave him and began working with him and things of this nature. The other thing is that the conviction of Chambliss.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was years before they convicted the other four, mm-hmm. three, because he was the first convicted one that was
1977.
He was the one convicted for killing Denise.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other ones were convicted later on.
Yeah.
But that's because of, relentless struggle and pursuit by some people. But did your family ever pursue, try to encourage the various organizations from the NAACP to Martin Luther King, them to try to pursue justice for the girls? Because Martin Luther King declared that one of the worst inhumane actions of that day, crimes against humanity of that day. He also said America was the biggest purveyor of violence. But did your parents ever pursue justice? I know they were forgiving, I mean, you write about how church spiritual they were with regard. I wouldn't say forgiving, but they were prayerful and positive about life and didn't want violence and didn't want, you know, I wouldn't call it a riot. I would call it rebellions in the street. But at the same time, did they pursue justice for Denise?
I'm sure that they did. I mean, Dad being in the legislature and knowing people, you know, in the legislature. The man who brought them, the first guy to justice was Bill Baxley. And he was the attorney general of the state of Alabama at that time. And Daddy knew him from the state legislature. But I can't answer that definitively. But I never had a conversation about, did you call the police station and say, help me, or talk to Dr. King and NAACP? I really don't know whether they did that or not. But I think you have to look at the time for which we're talking about. You know, at that point, getting a white man convicted of having killed a black person was not an option. So, you know, you could be complaining about it all day long, but we're talking about a very, very different time. And and I remember Daddy saying in the documentary for little girls that Spike Lee did, Bill Baxley asked him, do you want me to pursue Chambliss now that I'm attorney general? And he said, well, I think if you don't do it, nobody else would. But Bill was brave enough to do it. But it took another, from 1977 to 2001 before the next person was convicted. Nobody wanted to touch it. Nobody wanted to do it, you know. So that was just kind of the way it was around here.
I think Doug Jones.
Yeah, Doug Jones and his team of prosecutors got the last two killers in 2001 and 2002. But I really believe Spike's movie had a lot to do with that, because in his movie, he talks about, the movie was released in 97, which was 20 years after the Chambliss was convicted. Mm-hmm. And after that took place, people remember hearing in the movie that Chambliss was convicted, but they knew there were other people, and they kept saying, well, what about the other people? Are they going to be convicted? Are they going to be convicted? Are they going to be arrested? And shortly thereafter, the FBI reopened the case. And I like to think that that just didn't happen in a vacuum. I think that people started asking questions about it. And the FBI probably was like, okay, we need to do something about this. This is embarrassing.
Okay, now did you, okay, now the Klan still existed. I mean, after the bombing, they still...
Oh, yeah, the Klan still exists.
Yeah. When they never... these were members of the Klan. They were... Now, there was a person in one state that sued the Klan. Mm-hmm. And nobody decided in those days... Because Alabama was really rough. I understand that, you know. But there was no lawsuit against the Klan as an organization for... the destruction of the church or anything like that.
No.
Now, what are you doing in Alabama? What do you do there now?
What I do now is I do this work with traveling the country, talking about the bombing and reconciliation and unity. So that's my full-time job.
Did you go to school out there or college or anything?
Yeah, University of Alabama, Roll Tide. I also am a professional photographer myself, so I do that. So that's what I do here.
Okay. Now, you went to the University of Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
What did you major in?
My first major was communications, but I ended up with psychology.
Okay. So did you graduate from there?
No, I went on to UAB and was almost finished And my daddy begged me to come leave school and come work for him. Okay. And, you know, can't say no to daddy.
No. Now, I ask the question, do they have a commemoration day in Alabama for that recognition or appreciation or the sacrifice?
Yeah, the church always does a wonderful recognition. Every year they have a program at the church for the four girls. And they always honor the four girls and then also remember the two little boys who were also killed in racial violence on that day, Virgil Ware and Johnny Robinson. They remember that. But yeah, they do a nice service every September 15th, no matter what day of the week that falls on. They do that.
September 15th.
Mm-hmm.
Right. What do you think, you know, your letters, is to keep the name of Denise alive and keep people thinking about her sacrifice and her martyrdom with regards to the death. What are some of the other things you would like to see with regards to current Alabama changed or that you think is important for the people to struggle for or to challenge? Because there's still, you know, people ask people, you know, why do people stay down there, especially Black people, when it was so rough and so bad? And even to a certain day, you know, there's a lot of people that migrated from Alabama to other cities. But then there's a lot of people that stayed, even though it was a rough place to live. What type of mentality or consciousness you think drive people to say, hey, I'm going to stick this out, even though they're not treating us right and we can't vote at times and, you know, what they were putting you through?
Well, people would ask my dad that all the time. And he said this was home. First, he said, where else could he have gone and it would have been any better? And in a lot of ways, that made sense. But also, he was like, this was home. And you have to fight for your home to be better. So I admire that they stayed. It's hard to leave. I've tried to leave several times myself. My first trip to Los Angeles, I was like, oh, I got to get back over here. I can't go back to Alabama. I got to come. And so I was there last week. You know, my relatives, they are like, so you need to come back and stay. So, you know, I'm often tempted, extremely tempted, especially now that my parents are no longer living and I don't really have a reason to stay here. You know, what I do, I could do anywhere in the world. And this is home. There's some things about this place that are, believe it or not, are really great. And people are really, really great. People have been very kind, white people and Black people. Okay. Kind and supportive, not just fake, superficial kind. I thought you're always going to run somebody like that. But, you know, my sister's here. My brother-in-law's here. You know, my business connections to my photography business are here. I've got family here. So, you know, we just...
Rasha Key. Are you there, Rasha Key? Brotherhood? Rasha Key, you on mute? Take over from now, Rasha Key.
Yeah, man.
Okay, go ahead, Rasha Key. You take over for right now.
Okay. Okay, so very interesting, the things that you were speaking of. And I got to get the book. I haven't been politically inclined for years. I used to depend on my father to, you know, to get us informed about who we should vote for and all of that. Now that my father, he's been gone a year, that means that I have to start doing things to be more publicly aware. And plus we have this organization, the Community Education Network.com, our website, you know, as time moved forward, I'm going to push to get a program that's going to geared towards making people more politically aware and also to groom future politicians, because I know the importance of it. And just listening to your story and the things that you're doing is just more inspiration to keep moving forward in the direction I'm going in. I'm real, you know, appreciative of Brotherhood getting you to come and speak with us and give us your story and share. And it's just a good inspiration for myself, and I'm pretty sure for others. So Brotherhood, is there anything yes. else you wanted to add? Because I know we've been over an hour
yeah,
now.
We've
so.
Gone
no,
on
no,
track.
I'm good. I'm just appreciative of her time, and I appreciate everybody on the panel. And again, thank you, Ms. McNair, for sharing with us and accepting this invitation. And I really do appreciate it.
Well, thank you all for having me, and y'all keep up doing the good work and informing your people and the young people about voting and being a part of the process. It's important.
Yes. And you're always welcome. We have open, it's open to the public. We have many, many, many videos. We have 222. This is going to make 223. And so we're building a wealth of information on this platform, and you're welcome to come back. We Mr. Hood hopefully keeps in contact with you so we can get you back on and, you know, and keep us up to date on, you know, all of your goings and comings. So just appreciate you being here.
All right. Well, same here. And thank you all so much. And y'all have a blessed 2023.
You too.
Okay, you
take
do
care.
The same thing. So we're going to take a pause. We had Bob Marley's son on here a couple of weeks ago. And he and I used to always say, we're going to end. He said, no, we're just going to pause. So he coined that for us because we relatively knew. We've just been doing this for 2 years. So we're going to take a pause. And I want to say, each one, teach one in Conscious Corner. Everybody have a good evening.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Have a good evening.